You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds. From Stokes Family Office.
All right, Doug and Greg Stokes, Lanyap Podcast. It is August 11th. School is about to start and summer's coming to an end. A lot's happened the last week. Specifically, inflation data came out yesterday. The market started off the day strongly and then faded towards the end of the day. Markets have been a little bit wobbly over the last few weeks, and to some, that's welcomed after a huge run-up the first half of the year, specifically in NASDAQ-related stocks. One perma-bear, John Hussman, had a nice little quote I want to start today's podcast off with, and then just talk about these types of people in general. But this is a tweet. It says, longtime bear and asset bubble expert John Hussman, who called the 2000 and 2008 crashes, has warned the extreme bubble in stocks will end in tears, with S&P 500 plunging 64%. What is your take on the alarming prediction? So this is a typical fear-mongering tweet, and I'll back that up by just pulling a couple articles that somebody posted related to John Hussman. This is from February 14th, 2011. John Hussman, this is now one of the most expensive markets of all time. That was 12 years ago. I think the market is three or four times since then. October 27th, 2014, Hussman, I think the stock market is crashing. That's a Business Insider article. This is Business Insider from February 20th, 2016. One smart stock market analyst thinks this is where we're heading, and it's a huge downward spiral in markets, and it's John Hussman, the calm before the storm in 1929. And then this is from 2019, October 12, 2019. The worst of all possible worlds. One renowned stock bear is crying foul on an increasingly vulnerable part of the market, and reiterating his call for a 65% crash. So 2019, he called for a 65% crash, and the market is up almost 2x since then. Now he's calling for a 64% crash. So back to where we were in 2019. So there's a lot of people coming out of the woodworks after a big run-up first 6 or 7 months of 2023, saying that the end is near. Hussman has been sort of the ringleader of those perma bears. And just for a little bit of perspective, he's been calling for a crash since he predicted it first in 2008. And I think this is just a classic example of a broken clock is right twice a day. Sooner or later, he'll be right. But over the last 15 years, he's been pretty much wrong on every call.
Right. Well, he was one of the guys that, like, when 2008, 2009, when the world ended, his fund was actually up that year. So he got a lot of fun. What happens is these sort of charlatans will make these prognostications and be right every so often. Like you said, the broken clock's right twice a day or whatever. And they get a ton of new capital. And then they still have to continue to make these calls and to attract new capital. This is just a thing that's existed throughout the existence of humanity, with snake oil salesmen and everything. But he's going to be right eventually. The big thing that you have to take into account from the perspective of an investor is that go into investing with the expectation that once every decade or so, something's going to break. And if you have that expectation that the world's going to break every decade or so on average, then it should be conceivably easier to get through it. There's prime examples. If you look back over the last 20 or 30 years with COVID and the global financial crisis and 9/11 before that, and then you have all kinds of things that happened back in history where there's been radical changes and the markets have responded accordingly. But if you subscribe that those things are going to happen all the time, it's really been a bad strategy. And this individual Hussman, his fund has been the returns have been absolutely horrible since that one time, basically, that he was right 14, 15 years ago.
Yeah. So just to add to that, he has a mutual fund that's his flagship fund, Hussman Strategic Growth. Earliest available data, this is from Morningstar, the fund launched July 24th, 2000. Compound annual return of the fund over the last 23 years, 0.7% per year. Just for comparison, the Vanguard total stock market over that same time frame compounded at 8% per year. So a lot of the hysteria that he is throwing out, if you would just close your eyes, you've had a pretty good period over the last 23 years compared to trying to prognosticate doom and gloom. So we'll start today's podcast off with that. Greg, what else are you looking at in markets?
Well, it made me think of that you have these people that are prognosticating doom and gloom, but you have people on the other side of the equation where they think that there's the second coming of whatever in terms of a new business magnate or the first trillionaire or whatever. And I saw an interesting statistic of this guy, Adam Neumann's company.
WeWork.
Yeah. So WeWork at its peak in 2019, which WeWorks are great. I mean, if you go there, it's like these brand new buildings and there's free amenities like coffee and cold brew and everything's nice. And it's very inexpensive. Like I've done WeWorks when I've traveled and when there's been hurricanes or whatever. I worked at a WeWork in Texas for a couple of weeks. But anyway, the WeWork valuation at its peak in 2019 was $47 billion. As of yesterday, it's valued at $274 million. So this guy was this guy attracted money from what's that fund in Asia?
SoftBank.
SoftBank attracted all this money from VCs and like that this guy was going to change the office work culture and everything. He eventually ended, it looked like he was just like this sort of mirage. The same thing happened when I was thinking about as this guy, Adam Neumann, was known to walk barefoot in the office. And
he's like a shaman.
He's a prolific weed smoker. And like there was a story on Business Insider about how he was flying private and the captain of the airplane had to put on like the oxygen mask so, because it was like so much fumes or whatever in the airplane. But the investors get the idea that this is like, this guy's going to change the world, just like the opposite of the Hussman type guy, but still a snake oil salesman, charlatan in his own way. And it made me think of Sam Bankman-Fried, who's like another sort of, Neumann's not necessarily a fraud per se, but Sam Bankman-Fried was a fraud, and he had the same sort of, that he had tricked people that are very smart investors that he was the second coming, and it made me think of that.
Yeah, Jim story. Cramer called him J.P. Morgan reincarnate.
Are you serious? I didn't know that. That's the perfect description from Cramer. But it like I don't remember which venture capital fund it was, but it might have been like Sequoia or one of these like super chic got things where it's all Stanford grads or Harvard or whatever, and these guys said, I think I'm looking at the first trillionaire, and he was playing some computer game. I think it was League of Legends or whatever during the pitch meeting, and they thought he was so cool. And anyway, it's the same. It's the opposite feeling of what Hussman's providing, where he's trying to scare people. These people essentially are selling something the other side of the equation, where they're trying to play into people's greed instead of their fear. But Neumann's prime example that thing's worth basically nothing now. It doesn't work renting these buildings that nobody works in that gives away free stuff. It's the same thing's going to happen with other industries that people get really excited about. There's people that are going to play into people's emotions.
That's a good segue. So this is by no means a snake oil salesman industry. This is just simply a valuation comment. And this was Jeremy Schwartz of WisdomTree. Put this data together related to companies that trade at high valuations. And he was specifically targeting NVIDIA, which is sort of the darling of the AI age, because NVIDIA's GPUs, their chips, have essentially a monopoly on new AI infrastructure. And so this is a post that he outlined related to NVIDIA. And he says, the odds are stacked against you at 40 times trailing and 25 expected sales, NVIDIA joined the club of 99 companies with the highest price to sales multiple within 500 largest stocks in the last 60 plus years. Some stats on winners, losers from these 99 companies. And basically it goes into say that the losers, so there were some winners out of this group, but the vast majority were losers. And he said the 10-year losers grew sales at 23% per year for a decade with a median total return of 0%. Imagine growing sales almost 20% a year, more than typical stocks, for a decade, but still lagging the market by 10% a year on price. Those are the odds for companies that reach NVIDIA's vaunted status of the focus stock with the highest multiple in the market. Will NVIDIA be one of the few lucky winners from these multiples? And so all of this comes back to like there's hype, right? So AI is very hyped right now. We talked about it on a previous podcast, but and I think that goes back to WeWork as well. When you've hyped up a stock or a company enough where everyone is piling into it, it trades at a valuation that long term may just not make sense. And NVIDIA is definitely a real company and they're one of the biggest companies in the world, but at the same time, how do you justify a valuation when throughout history, valuations similar to these have just not worked out from a return perspective?
Right. You can say the same thing with a lot of those COVID stocks like Peloton and DocuSign that like were trading at 40 times revenue numbers at a certain point in time. Like, I mean, Peloton would have to be omnipresent for the rest of humanity and continue to grow and take market share and everything. And the fact of the matter is that obviously that didn't happen, but they're probably pretty similar numbers to this WeWork situation where, I mean, like who wants to ride a Peloton anymore? I mean, I think there's probably some people doing it, but it's like, that just reminds me of COVID and I want to be outside or whatever. But anyway, we're talking about the losers. I saw some statistics on the winners. This is some data, cash on hand as of the most recent quarterly filings, cash on hand by Apple, $167 billion, Berkshire, $150, Microsoft, $118, Amazon, $65, Meta, $53, Tesla, $23 billion. So those companies are still trading at probably pretty high valuations relative to their historical numbers, but they've actually printed cash instead of run out of cash. And shifting gears to individuals that are doing really well, the UPS and their, I don't know if it was a union or whatever, their drivers, I don't know if this is, you saw this, Doug,
yeah,
but their drivers are set to make $170,000 a year at the end of their current contract. So some companies doing really well, and UPS drivers look like an emerging market for financial advisors to be prospecting from.
Right, exactly. Just that's amazing to me. But I mean, the supply demand mismatch that as e-commerce and just logistics and delivery get more and more prevalent and drivers don't increase, then existing drivers are going to be making a lot more money. So I wonder if Elon Musk's self-driving truck is going to take out those UPS drivers sometime soon, but market's not saying so.
Right. So I want to shift gears kind of on the same topic as it relates to Elon Musk, but this is the WTI oil rises to nearly a 9-month high. It's at $84 a barrel. About 6 weeks ago, it was in the 60s. So things have changed quite quickly. And we talked about how these things like crypto, in the case of Sam Bankman-Fried, we're talking about electric cars, all these sort of and then we talked about venture capitalists too, as well too earlier on. So these are the sort of sexy areas where people were wanting to work in, and AI is the new thing that people are talking about right now. The thing that has not been sexy is oil. We talked about that quite a bit, and that's really represented in this data from the Wall Street Journal article about undergraduate petroleum engineer enrollment in select U.S. universities. And I'm just going to go through this in detail. We graduated college, and I graduated in 2009. I think you graduated in 2010. So this is kind of the same period when we were looking at when we were enrolled in college. But relative to that time period in the mid-2000s to today, the change in undergraduate petroleum engineer enrollment at UT Austin is down 42%, Texas A&M down 64%, Texas Tech down 89%, Colorado School of Mines down 88%, LSU down 90%, Oklahoma State University down 90%. I wonder if there's going to be a sort of shift in the sort of perception of oil and the enrollment in the schools as it relates to this new spike in the price of oil. I would love to get your thoughts on
that. I think you can see the same thing in the market. I just pulled this up, Vanguard Energy ETF. So this is just an exchange traded fund that tracks an energy index. Current price to earnings ratio for the Vanguard Energy ETF, 6.4 times earnings. The market trades at around 19 times earnings, the U.S. stock market. So nobody's going into petroleum engineering, and no dollars are going into energy. And so, you know, typically that's a situation, at least over the long term, where you want to be moving towards where people are exiting. And valuations reflect that in markets. And so what was hot over the last 7 or 8 years, software engineering and coding and, green energy, and everybody's moving from petroleum to that sort of, discipline. And I think, from a valuation perspective, it's pretty amazing that you can buy companies from a cash flow perspective at 20% earnings yields, and basically get paid back, so long as that earnings don't go down, which of course they do in very commodity cyclical type industries. But if earnings stay flat or don't go down, you essentially get paid back in 5 or 6 years in these types of companies. So I would say it's just evident across the board in fossil fuels that it's unsexy right now. And my personal perspective, and I think this is perspective of people like Warren Buffett, because he's been buying Occidental Petroleum hand over fist, is that fossil fuels are not going away anytime soon. And so there's going to be a need for jobs in petroleum engineering. And these companies are going to persist because oil is still in demand and growing. And so it's just pretty interesting that capital has just gone completely away from this industry.
Yeah, that is crazy interesting. And obviously, it's going to be, I saw a statistic earlier today that we're at peak oil, according to the IEA, or I don't know what the acronym is, but the International Energy Association. Whether or not that continues is really anybody's guess. But certainly, there's industries that are never going to be able to go full electric, like planes, for example. And I saw an interesting thing as it relates to U.S. airfares. They've increased 29% since 1995, but have actually declined 36% adjusting for inflation. So that's really sort of interesting. Another thing it's completely shifting gears that you had brought up and I had seen, which is really just kind of astounding, but Phil Mickelson allegedly bet over $1 billion over the last 10 years.
Yeah. So this is this new book that's coming out. I think the background here is that one of Phil Mickelson's close friends, or maybe a manager or agent or something, they were accused of some insider trading several years ago, and Phil sort of turned on this guy. This is the story, at least. So this guy coming out, Billy Walters, is now writing a book on Phil, basically blasting him. And so the story is, over the last 3 decades, Phil Mickelson allegedly lost close to $100 million gambling, tried to bet on a Ryder Cup that he was competing in, and made 43 bets on MLB games in one day. That's just some of the highlights from the book that's coming out. But it's pretty amazing. This is going to be a very scathing review of Phil Mickelson from an insider and a former friend. And I wonder how much of it is true, but it's getting a lot of news. I mean,
you got a problem. He's got a problem, man. 43 baseball games in one. First of all, I don't even know if I could watch one baseball game.
Yeah, he came out and said that people are aware that he has a problem, but that doesn't really explain. There's a difference between a problem where you gamble maybe, I don't know, for somebody like him, like I think $100,000 a year in gambling would be a big problem that needs to be addressed. But $100 million in losses over a couple decades is that's more than a problem.
Yeah. I mean, he was like the golden boy after Tiger's stuff. And looks like he's got his share of problems as well too.
Jesus. Yeah, I know. We'll see. We'll see what happens with that, but I'm eager to read it. It's coming out. I think it actually might be out already, but I'm a fan of golf, and I've always been sort of a pro Tiger, even though he's had his share of issues, and anti-Phil when they were major rivals. So it'll be interesting to read this book on him.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. But look at the 43 baseball games batting in one.
I think it was something like 200,000 per game. And I'm trying to find the, So I think it was 43 baseball games, and what Billy Walters said, the average bet was $200,000.
I mean, I guess it's all relative, right? So his net worth is probably so high that you can't do $10 bet if you're Phil Mickelson. But I mean, just wow, I just don't understand. But I guess that's addiction right there. That's not normal, obviously.
Right. Well, do we want to wrap this up with, we're at 20 minutes now, Greg. One thing I wanted to actually talk about before we wrapped up, and this is important because we note it every week, and so let's just continue to talk about it, and then we can close for the day. But inflation, we didn't really talk about the numbers. So inflation came in less than expected, and this is from Charlie Bilello, who we quote a lot on this podcast, and this is his digging into the data. But what he said was, and it's pulling up now, U.S. CPI has moved down from a peak of 9.1% in June 22 to 3.2% today. What's driving the decline? Lower rates of inflation in fuel, oil, gas utilities, used cars, medical care, electricity, apparel, new cars, food at home, and food away from home. Shelter and transportation are the only components that have a higher inflation rate than June 22. Shelter now represents, of the 3.2%, 90% of that is, so basically 3% of that is shelter inflation. And so we've talked about that extensively. It seems like the disinflationary forces are pretty strong, and I would expect that inflation continues to come down, specifically core CPI, which excludes energy because energy spiked back up. But shelter is unbelievable. That's higher now than it was 12 months ago from an inflation perspective. That's the lag effect at work.
Yeah, Colin Roche posted something interesting about the loan originations in the United States. And it went through like the mid to late 2000s, where we had that huge housing boom, subprime mortgage crisis, and then looked at it relative to the last 3 or 4 years. We had a really big spike in COVID, but basically it's like it's exponentially lower mortgage originations presently than it has been since the whole Fed rate rising cycle started. And you would just think that eventually that sort of thing matriculates down to the home prices. It really hasn't affected things so far. And actually there's been home price increases in certain priced homes, like 250,000 to 750,000 has shown a lot of strength. But if you look at the luxury home market, especially, there's been, those rates make it really cost prohibitive for people to be buying right now. And I do agree that there's going to be some major headwinds as it relates to inflation, because that is such a huge component to the equation. It's close to 50% of the inflationary numbers come from shelter, and we really haven't seen the full brunt of that yet. So I would not be surprised if that's going to be the sort of driving story and going to be the headwind for inflation, which is a good thing, because then that wouldn't necessarily mean the Fed has to stop doing what it's been doing. Speaking of the Fed rate rising cycle as it relates to the markets, the inflationary numbers came in pretty good yesterday. There's no surprises or anything like that. So the as it relates to what the market is perceiving right now, there's probably going to be one more increase in the rate rising cycle, and then by the end of 2024, the Fed rates, the market's probability of the Fed rate is going to be in the threes versus where it is in the fives right now. So it's probably going to be some cuts over the next 14 or 15 months, according to the market. So a lot of interesting things going on. Like we mentioned previously, the and you just talked about the price of oil is going to start to be factored in. But there's things like that that you can't control. You can't control certain things with like the Fed rate rising because there's supply and demand aspects. Like the Saudis, for example, can cut their oil output, and that really doesn't play into the things that the Fed can control easily. But it'll be there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen.
Yep. And we'll pick this up next week. We appreciate you listening. Hope everyone had a nice summer and everybody's getting back into the swing of things with, back from vacation and school starting up mid-August. So tune in next week. And while you're at it, give us a 5-star review and give us a comment and help boost this podcast to more listeners.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lanyap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lanyap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.